I wanted, and thanks, Jason, for the interview. Mine's going to be, or the introduction, mine's going to capitalize a little bit on what Ken said, a little bit on what Anand said, but we're going to talk about reciprocity. And as Jason said, I've been looking at consumer health informatics this year. We've been looking at these small proof of concepts to see in an iterative process in a kind of safe to fail but not fail safe environment, and really iterative. And so to see what has promise and what needs to be grown. So this is a small proof of concept that I'm going to present to you today that will help. Part of the aim was to help us achieve the Healthy People 2020 objective of personally tailored information, as well as build a mutually beneficial dialogue with the public. All right, so the underlying idea here is that the days when we can take data and not give anything in return are done. I'm putting that out. I mean, you may not agree with this, but this is pretty much what we have been discussing for the past year of, you know, this is just, it's old. Just taking, 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 and giving nothing back, because it doesn't build a relationship and it doesn't build trust. But if we look at this truly as evolving informatics and evolving public health, we can really help achieve transparency. We can encourage citizen, I'm sorry.
So if we could hold that question.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
It's a great question, and let's hold that till the end of the presentation.
Right. So give back to citizens from who we frequently just take and contribute to improve public health. And I think when I'm talking about taking data from people, I'm talking from individuals and not giving anything to individuals back, as opposed to public health as a whole. Okay? So this is reciprocity. An evolution of cooperative altruistic behavior gives the probability of future mutual interactions. Okay. So this is a crazy diagram that I'm going to go ahead and load up. Oops, I need to go back. How do I go back? Okay. What this actually is trying, and I'm not sure the people in the back actually can see this, but what this is looking across different disciplines. So we're looking at not only chronic disease and some and diseases in general, the problems with diseases, but also looking at online social network research done by Megan Marino and Christakis and Fowler in recent, in this past year, maybe year and a half now, about obesity and also smoking in social networks. So people who smoke are more likely to be in social networks who smoke, kind of. We're also looking at behavior change theories and tailoring and modeling, and we know that giving people tailored information is more likely to have impact of knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors. We're looking at behavioral economics, and that's particularly the areas of trust and reciprocity. And then, of course, the tools of social network that we're talking about today. I put this up because what we're, and Jason mentioned this earlier, we're talking about impact on health. We are actually wanting to start from the end, thank you, Ken, of the logic model, and look backwards. We want to start from impacting health and then pick the tools that work. And because she wasn't here on Sunday, I would like to acknowledge Sandra Jackson for the help that she did in doing this logic model. So I'm only put this up here not to reiterate what Anand said, but to show you that, and also was brought up earlier, is that we evolve, technology evolves. So today it may be a social networking site, but tomorrow it may be Twitter, and then tomorrow it's something else. But as we look squarely in Web 2.0 in social networks, we have to be planning for the future. Okay, so here's another crazy model for you. This is reciprocity, right? Reciprocity, when you give back, builds trust. If you have somebody who has interest, you give them something back that builds trust, that builds a relationship. And then you have a whole bunch of this happening, right? And that has an impact, has a possibility of impacting risk behaviors, and attitudes. It also has a possibility of building altruism and sharing of public health data. And Ken mentioned this earlier. If we build these networks of people, so improve health and well-being. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship. So this project that I'm going to talk to briefly about is we worked with through the Cancer Research National Cancer Institute and their community, their centers of excellence, and this one particularly was in Michigan. And we looked at how we can take these really long health risk assessments and put them into tolerable chunks of information and then get a dialogue going. We get a little information, we give them a little information. We get a little bit more, and we give them more. So it's a tailored circle. And we develop that relationship based on our history and trust. These are some screenshots of that. So we were delivering this tailored information. We started the dialogue. If they agreed to download this app in MySpace, are you all familiar with MySpace? Some of you have the, okay. If they downloaded this app on their MySpace, they got an explicit statement that it's going to use a little bit of your existing data to get this discussion going. All right, so it used their age, their gender, to get this discussion going. And it gave them a little bit more information on asthma. And then it started tailoring, so the information that was going back to them. So we just did this little bitty test. We put it out there. We didn't promote it. It was based on a very well-tested, funded by NCI program called Puff City. And just in a little short time, a month, actually I think it was a month, we had just 19 people sign up. But it was enough for us to see, and they went through it, right? So it was enough for us to see it works. They signed up, they got the information, they went through the process, it gave. So that was what we were testing. So the lesson learned was it works. And the other lesson learned was MySpace was fine with it, because applications that are working in MySpace right now are for badges and for them to sell you something or customize something to you in the commercial environment already do this. So we were very worried, and public health is always very worried about privacy, as we very well should. But MySpace was really not so worried. And you'll see what we identified was that there needs to be explicit informed use. People really need to understand, if they download this app, what information is it going to be using, is it going to use, and where is that information going to be stored, and what's going to happen with it. We did do that. Not all applications do that. You obviously need social networking savvy developers and designers to do this. It makes it go faster, and they know how it works and how it needs to look. You also need robust information, right? So this was a very robust product on asthma, and it allowed that tailoring and customization that Michigan is so good at doing. But if you don't have that depth, it's very hard to give it back, right? So that is a challenge in itself, and it needs to be integrated in a program. As I started out saying, it needs to be looking at health to begin with, not at the technology. And there needs to be a value exchange. They have to get something if we're going to be taking something back. So opportunities. One great one that I see is, oh my gosh, we could shorten these health risk assessments. Like, it would be wonderful. Because that's a really big block oftentimes where people just don't fill out these health risk assessments. Some health risk assessments are literally 10 pages long. And we could instead chunk them up, give information back. It could be, as Christoskis and Fowler have been exploring, the smoking cessation and obesity could definitely have applications within social network sites to address these. And given that these apps can also be passed on to your friends as MySpace works, then people who are smoking, for example, would likely pass on that app to others who smoked. And so it would be much more targeted. Mental health and wellness, Ken mentioned this. Another possibility is to match resources and services of interest. If people have areas that they're interested in or things that they need to or that they would like to know about their community, we could do a much better job by getting a little information and giving a little bit back. Survey results is another one of giving information back. And Sentinel Citizens, I think Ken alluded to this too. You know, if people gave their information to public health to be tallied in a de-identified way at a higher level, at the same time they could be getting information back on what, you know, the topic of their interest, whether it be smoking cessation or weight control, as Ken mentioned. So here are a few resources, and they're online. And thank you very much. I wanted to acknowledge Jason, Ninad Mishra, and the University of Michigan team. And here's a little saying for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Susie. I think we're going to leave that up there. So let's go ahead and open it up for questions. I know that there was one early on. Yes.
Okay, so the question is, at the local level, people do get stuff back from public health. If they ask a question, they get information back, and that a lot of surveys are not done at the local level. We were really looking at this at the national level. We do a lot of surveys, a lot, from the national level. And we it could be calling, it could be the buses that go out and collect blood samples and all these crazy things. We do a lot of that. And very rarely do those individuals who participate actually get any of that information back, right? Or if they phone in information, for example. I mean, rarely at the national level do individuals get information back. But I don't think that that discount, and so I realize the difference between the local health department and the national level. But I still think, as a concept of, you know, being grounded in, if we take something, we give something back, is being done very well at the local health department level, and it's something we can learn at the national level.
Yes.
So these were great presentations, and I would like to see an entire 3-day conference dedicated to this, utilizing new technologies. No, some of these technologies aren't that new. I mean, so, but utilizing, you know, technologies that have been around for the last 10 years anyway. To answer the question about uses for Twitter, well, I work for a local health department, and we're using Twitter and also SMS for many things, and we're thinking about using Twitter to remind people about their second H1N1 vaccination. And we also have some text messaging projects underway to get people into young girls into family planning if they choose to do that, and to remind people about their ongoing vaccinations for their children. And actually for mental health services for women who are pregnant. But what we found is that you can't just have a wealth of information to send out. You have to have a culturally competent and generationally competent person working with a health educator, because you rarely get the two together, combined with the technical person. We're actually trying to create a position called a TJ, which would be a text jockey, because you know, if this is just unidirectional, you know, some of our communications will be bi-directional. I mean, you don't just want a machine to answer the questions. You know, they have to be personal, especially in the mental health realm. But we've had, you know, we're just now getting our feet wet in this. We had a project that we promoted on Facebook, and we didn't know what we were doing, and we got 8,000 hits right away. And so this is the way to get information out to a lot of people very cheaply. And so I would just like to see a conference dedicated to this. And one last thing, privacy will probably go away in 10 years. It won't exist. So just like books, I mean, unfortunately, but you know, it's like we need to like see where, you know, where we're going to land in 10 years so we don't get build a whole infrastructure that won't be needed.
So, and just real quick, I don't know if everybody heard that. So you can talk to this gentleman up here in your left-hand corner, but has, in a local public health department, considerable experience utilizing some of these tools to reach out to a variety of different segments of the population around services, reminders for immunizations. And I know we've had discussions with other health departments that are doing similar things, using it for communication campaigns and such. I'll get to you. In 2 weeks up in Toronto, there's a Medicine 2.0 conference where all of this stuff is discussed. It's a good conference. It's very small. It's only the second year, but it's a good one. And lastly, boy, making those kinds of statements about privacy, and I would hate to have you alone in a room with privacy people. So yeah, next question. Yeah, so the comment for everyone, if they didn't hear, was really engaging, and I think it was in your title, Ken, this notion of sentinel citizens, right? People are out there on the front lines reporting things in a restaurant, things that they see, code violations, et cetera, sort of normal public health practice kinds of things. You know, I imagine, you know, one of the questions would be, oh my God, what do you do with all that data? How do you ensure that data is actually valid and useful? And how do you separate out what's useful and what's not? And how do you then appropriately utilize the very, 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 very scarce and currently being furloughed local public health staff to do that kind of stuff? But you know, I think that's a good example of, you know, sort of the potential promise of such things, but then how do you operationalize it and make it real is right, really, yeah, the challenge. But I mean, it's a great observation.
Yeah, because local public health, I mean, they can't go out to inspections on restaurants. You know, I work for local public health.
Yeah.
Right. And they can only do restaurant inspections every so often. So that would, you know, engage the citizens. And yes, you're right. You would have to be able to look and make sure somebody isn't just trying to take a restaurant down or whatever.
Right. Right. Another question. Actually, we'll go in the back. Yeah.
Toolkit or how-to or some guidelines and best practices, and so that's a great idea.
Okay. I'll get that on there right away.
Yeah.
I had a question. If you build a web application and you interface with Twitter to use it as a messaging infrastructure,
right.
Now, are those messages that are going to be transmitted also, will it be logged? I guess it will be logged by Twitter.
Right.
Is there a possibility of Twitter then using that information or selling that information to an insurance company and things like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the question is basically, if you're utilizing the Twitter platform to do some of this work, is there the potential possibility of Twitter misappropriating that data or that information for purposes otherwise not intended?
Yeah, that's an issue. And, you know, when I started thinking about using Twitter in these ways, I wasn't necessarily thinking that Twitter was the platform to do these types of activities. Although the nice thing about it is it is free, and I actually wondered, you know, what if CDC approached Twitter in terms of, you know, changing their model a little bit to do some of these things, to add that capability to, I guess, indemnify in a sense what some of that data. I'm not sure if that's possible, but you know, those were some things that are going through my mind. And how do you deal with security and the privacy types of issues and them using the data, or anybody using that data, for instance?
Also related to that would be scalability and bandwidth. If you use Twitter, there's a whole lot of users.
Right. Well, I think he's asking about scalability and bandwidth of Twitter. I think that they are scaling up pretty heavily. And I don't think, I'm just making an assumption here. I'm assuming, considering the amount of traffic on Twitter today, the amount of funding that they have, the fact that at some point they are going to monetize the system. I don't know how they're going to do that. I've got some ideas about that. But, you know, I don't think there's going to be scalability issues. I mean, right now, what you've seen lately in the news is denial of service attacks against Twitter of people that are just like, I hate Twitter, I'm going to blow them up, and they put something out there just to bring them down. So the fact that they're even getting those denial of service attacks tells you that there's some fire there, and, you know, it's a powerful tool. So, you know, those, I think we're going to deal with that for a while. Yes? Right, so this gets back to why I'm sad that I didn't get a chance to actually write the application, because I think that, to me, the nice thing about Twitter specifically on mobile devices is, and texting, SMS texting, because we're just dealing with small packets of information, there's just so many, I mean, everybody has a cell phone, people don't even have home phones anymore, they use cell phones. And a lot of folks use texting, and that's become a really important way to communicate. So if somebody can develop an application that can, I mean, any application you build, you put it out on an Apple site, they could download it to their device. You could put another application for free that goes on your little mobile device, your cell phone that just runs a Java app. So they're nice, easy, simple ways to get these apps down. And then it's just a matter of usage. So, you know, publicizing them, getting people using them. If they're helpful, then people will start to adopt it. You know, I like that kind of open source methodology where you make these things available for free. If it provides a service, if it provides some utility, then people will use it. The idea is, you know, is take these ideas. That's why I asked the question, what other ideas out there? If we can kind of incorporate those ideas into some, you know, a set of applications that people would potentially use, then, you know, that's the way to get it into the community. Because if it's free, downloadable, easy to use.
Plus, you know, at this point, you know,
Right. You want to address that?
What was the question?
Oh, he's asking about, again, ask that question again.
As a statement.
Yeah, I thought it was more of a statement. So, yeah, we can just move on, keep on moving.
There's a website that's pretty good that incorporates with Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
It's dixel.com. And what they do is they send out not only the SMS messages and the website messages they post to the website, they actually also send emails out.
Right.
To the local residents, but also you can geo-target those people. So you can say, send out a message within a 10-mile radius, 15-mile radius, and they can always go back to the site and look at it.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of push. I think Twitter's about to open up their API to geolocation, and you were just talking about a site where you can actually geolocate tweets, and you can geolocate to within a range of where a person is located.
It's nixel.com.
Nixel.com.
Yeah.
Nixle.
Nixle.com.
Yes. Have we considered Google Apps? What specific Google app are you thinking, or you think of that as a platform?
You can create your own Google Apps using
Google Apps. Yeah. I mean, like I said, there's so much available. I think the point is that all these tools are available. It's just getting people to think, to start to use these tools and to figure out really neat and cool ways to make them useful for public health. Tom? What's up?
Well, no, I see myself as that site as a public health professional, because that site monitors all the Twitter live. So in other words, it literally, when the stuff with the rant happened, it was 800 tweets per second that were literally offline, and you start to get a sense of sort of what's going on in mass. So
that's true.
It's almost create an interface to that application that would say, if threshold tweets per second on this text, this word item, reach a threshold, alert me, and then
no, that's a great.
It's not an app like my iPhone, but it's a
right. But it's tapping into a stream of data that is live and rich, and you know, why can't public health use those streams of data to take public health action? I mean, that's the bigger picture here. It's to use the tooling and the social networking and the streams of data that are in existence today and that are only growing, it tap into them for public health use. Yes? Tom, come up.
No, you can read it.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, the pound sign. Yeah. Right.
They write something so that people start looking for H1N1 related. What I think CDC could do, or public health could do, is say for those that are going to be using this, here's some key words we want you to use. So it's almost like they have a guide so that we can sort of guide them in what keywords to be used, so it's not sort of, it's cleaner.
Right, right.
Yeah,
No, you're right, which gets back to the what the other gentleman was saying in terms of you know, what are the standards and educating people in terms of how to use and how to manage, but getting the word out. And what he was saying is that, like, you can go and just search on H1N1, and there are sites where you can, do you guys, everybody seen The Matrix? And you know, in The Matrix, there's the screen where it's like the data is falling down the screen, raining. And that's kind of like Twitter. It's like, if you look at it, and you know how to look at it, you actually can figure out what it means. But Twitter's kind of like that, where if you can figure out what the symbols and things mean, you can actually make sense of it and see what's happening inside the matrix, so to speak. But like with, if you do #H1N1, there's these sites where you can say, I want to watch everything that has to do with H1N1, public health, or something else, social networking, and you will start seeing just streams and streams of tweets of everybody in the world talking about that or tweeting about those specific items. It's a little overwhelming, you know, just to see that just up on the screen. So again, how do we tap into that stream and how do we analyze that stream?
So let me add just a slightly different perspective. So, you know, there's just tons and tons of data. And so that's always very interesting for epidemiologists, data, data, data. And so one of the challenges that we brought up earlier was this notion of how exactly do you validate the data? How is it made useful? We can sort of put all our hopes and faith in natural language processing and data mining, and maybe that'll prove out to, I don't know. But on a more practical side, from a communication standpoint, I know that at CDC, some of the centers in and some of the folks who are in health communications are focused very much in utilizing Twitter as a tool to put out health messages. And so that's one. But the next layer down is applying social network analysis on top of that to really to understand who are their super spreaders. Who are the people in the networks who are the massive spreaders of their information? And how do they change and utilize the network that is emerging there to further impact public health? I think it's a real world, very applicable understanding of sort of not just Twitter, just throw it out there and let twits tweet, but to really begin to really understand what does that network look like and how to leverage that network for ultimately public health outcomes.
So getting to data validation from the consumer end, it's just evolutionary. I mean, many of us who are my age certainly watched TV when we were kids and saw the really cool toy that you got out of the box of cereal on the television commercial, but when you did get the toy, it was a piece of crap. And we learn to discern, you know, most of us, you know, by the time we're 15, we know the feed-free camera that you get with something that's, you know, it's all a lie. When Wiki first came into existence, everyone was saying, oh, it's terrible, anyone could write anything, but people have learned to discern the good from the bad. I mean, and my nieces and nephews were all young. They get it. They could spot something that's junk right away, you know, before, I, you know, it takes me a while to do the analytics to figure it out. So I think that that's just a process. As for the, what you do to the data, I mean, you know, it's, there are so many cool things that are like, that are meaningless, but it's just, it's so much fun. So part of what this gentleman, you know, about the misuse, I mean, part of the beauty of Twitter is completely open. There are other services that you can use that are more controlled, where you know you can limit access and there's not the data mining going on. But there's something called Ask Twitter. I don't know if you've seen that one, where it geocodes it to the geographic location of the IP address, each message, and these messages just start popping up all over the world. And interestingly enough, regardless of the alphabet, people seem to use H1N1 in our alphabet, and so, you know, I can't tell what half the messages say, but I can recognize H1N1 when I use search that way.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Back in the early 90s, there was this phenomenon called ProMed.
Called what?
ProMed.
ProMed.
Mm-hmm.
It's still up, available, sure. Running, yep. Fully operational.
Right.
So you get a filtration among your peers of whether your report will be sent in as authentic or not. There might be some lessons in that model.
Hmm.
Even though that was pure text at the point of the first
right.
Pure text and a vetted population versus the unfettered masses, right?
Right.
So.
But the
Yeah,
it's a good example.
I think, I mean, back to Susie's point, I love the big analytics piece because I mean, how could you not like lots of data and analyzing data? But the social aspect is so important from the personalization of it. And, you know, the Twitter is just so personal. So much so that, like I said, you get too many tweets coming to your phone, it actually irritates you and you're wanting to turn it off. So, you know, the challenge is how to use these technologies to create those relationships with, you know, with public health and, you know, with who could actually help people with whatever, you know, some kind of health issue that they've got. And I was thinking, somebody was saying something, I thought, well, kind of a cool add-on to this application would be, you know that this is a public health application and it's helping me with my, you know, whatever chronic disease I may be dealing with, but at the same time, there could be a tap that actually can give you a list, show you where you are geolocated on a map, and then show you where public health offices departments are around your area. You know, I don't know where, you know, where I live, but I'm not sure where there's a public health department where I could go someplace and get some help. But, you know, just to have that knowledge that, oh, there's a public health department right around the corner or 10 miles away or whatever, you know, just something that simple, just that interface that just kind of makes those connections that don't really exist today. Because everything right now is so targeted, you know, okay, I need to do a Google search for a public health department, and I have to go to Google, get on my computer, pull up Google Maps, public health department, boom, and then weed through all, you know, all the junk that comes up. Where, you know, you have something more personalized, something that's helps you to build that trust relationship. You know, those things I think are really interesting.
Just like the browser, when they, you know, you get like your SSL and HTTPS name, do you see to handle a privacy issue? Even Twitter, if an application is using the Twitter's messaging in the platform, even before it goes into Twitter, the message could get probably encrypted, go via Twitter, and then once it's on the other end, you know, decrypt. Do you see that happening?
He's asking if he sees a day where Twitter could be encrypted up and down. That's a good question. I think my gut says no. I can't imagine, I'm just trying to think of what massive use case for that, unless they were funded to do something like that.
Don't you think Iran?
Oh, there you go. There's a use case.
No, because of public privacy.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Oh, in Google Apps you can?
Yes.
He says in Google Apps you can encrypt the way the data is stored. Which gets to the point of the cloud, which is, you know, storing personal data in the cloud. If you can encrypt it, you have some level of assurance or safety that even if somebody could get access to the data, they couldn't actually crack the data and do something with it. Yeah. I mean, those are all those things that are swirling around and, you know, dealing with these new technologies. Tom? Okay. You just stretching? No, thumbs up. Okay, good. Thumbs up.
Are there any other questions? All right. Thanks for a lively discussion, and thanks to all our presenters this afternoon.